Forget frequently asked questions.
Common sense, common knowledge, or Google.
How about advice from a real genius? 95% of people in any profession are good enough to be qualified and licensed. 5%
go above and beyond.
They become very good at what they do, but only
0.1%.
are real geniuses. Richard Jacobs has made it his life's mission to find them for you. He hunts down and interviews geniuses in every field. Sleep science, cancer, stem cells, ketogenic diets, and more. Here come the geniuses. This is the Finding Genius Podcast
with Richard Jacobs.
Hello, this is Richard Jacobs with the Finding Genius Podcast. I have Juliana Rangel-Posada. She's an associate professor of apiculture, Department of Entomology and Interdisciplinary Program in Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at Texas A&M University. So, Juliana, thanks for coming.
Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, it looks like you're researching honeybees. What are you researching?
In general, at a broader scale, our lab, we study the biological and abiotic factors that affect the health of managed honeybees in the United States. So we do all kinds of research related to diseases, pathogens, parasites, pesticide exposure, nutrition, and their synergistic interactions that affect the health of honeybees.
Oh, if you were to rank what affects the health of honeybees from, you know, strongest to weakest, what are some of the top things that that cause them health problems?
Yeah, so the number one problem in apiculture in the United States continues to be a parasitic mite called Varroa destructor. This mite is originally a parasite of relative of the Western honeybee, the Asian honeybee, Apis serrana. But about 30 years ago, it jumped hosts and started parasitizing the Western honeybee that we have here in the United States and Europe and Africa. And the Western honeybee wasn't really prepared to combat the Varroa mite. And so it's taken the bees and the beekeepers several decades to try to manage Varroa-related issues. So imagine if you were a bee and you had a mite on your body, the size of the mite would be very similar to a paper plate in size. That's the age, the size difference between a mite on a bee and a mite. The size of the mite on a human would be about the size of a paper plate, and sometimes these bees have two or three or four of these mites on them. And so the mite sucks the some of the fluids from the bee for its nutrition, but it also transmits over 24 viruses that weaken the immune system of honeybees. So that's still the number one problem. But we have issues with other pathogens. Of course, the viruses that Varroa vectors, is fungal pathogens, other types of insect pests. Poor nutrition is one of the top health-related issues in honeybee colonies, because sometimes they don't get the amount of nutrition that they need to withstand all of these stressors. Habitat loss, so urbanization and decrease in natural forage for honeybees is one of the big problems. We also have pesticide exposure. So either the bees that are collecting nectar and pollen from flowers are bringing back on their bodies and in the food they collected traces of also sorts of agrochemicals that are used in agricultural crops, or what's even worse or more common is the chemicals that the beekeepers apply to the colonies to get rid of all of these problems that I'm telling you. So pesticide exposure from the outside and from within are a big, big issue. And finally, queen problem. So a honeybee colony is headed by one reproductive female. That's the queen. She lays about 1,000 to 2,000 eggs a day, and that turn into female workers. The workers do all the tasks that are non-reproductive, while the queen is the one that does the reproductive mating and egg laying. And we're seeing a lot of issues in the last decade or more of poor queen quality, queens dying early or prematurely. And so all of these issues that I just told you are wreaking havoc in our colonies and are typically acting all at once.
Yeah, that's crazy. So what's some new learnings in terms of keeping bees in a healthy way? You know, not spraying them to death with chemicals. Like what are some of the suggestions?
Yeah, so we do in my lab have done a lot of work on the reproductive quality of queens and drones. Drones are the male honeybees. And we've shown that exposure to these chemicals, the agrochemicals that either the foragers bring in on their bodies, but most importantly, the miticides, we call those miticides are the chemicals that we use to kill mites, the varroa mites, and that those are causing health issues to the very bees that we want to save. So the queens and the drones that are exposed to those chemicals in the wax that they grow up in as baby bees, as larvae and pupae, having wax that's contaminated with those chemicals actually causes the queens and the drones to have lower reproductive quality. And we do that in many ways. We take out the adults and we measure how many drones the queens mated with, for example, or how much sperm the drones can provide during mating. And we've shown that being exposed to these chemicals lowers the viability of the sperm and the quality, reproductive quality of queens and drones. So there's no way that we can recommend not to do anything about varroa, because it is clear now that colonies that don't get treated for varroa will probably collapse within 1 or 2 years if they are left untreated. But we are making an argument for beekeepers becoming more aware of the chemicals that they're putting into their colonies, trying to maybe take turns between treatments so that the mites don't become resistant to these products, and do some sort of integrated pest and pollinator management where the beekeepers can replace their wax every so often, maybe every couple of years, so that the wax, because the wax is kind of like a sponge, so you don't want the wax to continuously collect all these chemical residues that then are trapped in the wax matrix. You want to replace the wax with new wax every few years so that it's clean and not full of chemicals.
What do you mean replace the wax? I thought the bees make the wax.
The bees make the wax. That's true. They make comb. And so, but it stays there and then they keep reusing it and reusing it, right? The bees use the same cells over and over, but because they're bringing in all these chemicals and the beekeepers are applying chemicals to the colonies and it involves also the wax getting contaminated, we recommend that beekeepers take the frames out, take the wax out of the frames, or use new frames, which are wooden frames with just a wire foundation for the bees to kind of start the process again and build new comb that hasn't collected all of those chemicals in the last few years. So
in the honeybee hive, once they make wax, how long do they keep it for?
Oh, they will keep it indefinitely for as long as the colony lives. But we have to remember that honeybees live in the natural world, not the artificial beekeeping world. They live in tree cavities that are very spaced out between each other, between colonies. You know, you can have maybe one colony in one tree and then another colony in, I don't know, a few hundred feet away. So they're not really crammed like we cram them into our apiaries, and they don't get treated for anything. So their wax is clean. They don't, maybe they bring in a little bit of pesticides from the outside. But as I said, the harsher chemicals are the ones that they collect from being exposed to them by beekeepers. So colonies will have their combs in use for years until the colony dies. But beekeepers can do something about chemical contamination by removing the very old frames and replacing them with new foundation that the bees can then use to build new comb, cleaner comb.
Before we continue, I've been personally funding the Finding Genius podcast for 4.5 years now, which has led to 2,700 plus interviews of clinicians, researchers, scientists, CEOs, and other amazing people who are working to advance science and improve our lives and our world. Even though this podcast gets 100,000 plus downloads a month, we need your help to reach hundreds of thousands more worldwide. Please visit findinggeniuspodcast.com and click on Support Us. We have three levels of membership from $10 to $49 a month, including perks such as the ability to see ahead in our interview calendar and ask questions of upcoming guests, transcripts of podcasts you're interested in, the ability to request specific topics or guests, and more. Visit findinggeniuspodcast.com and click Support Us today. Now back to the show.
So if you go in and you take the wax out of a nest, I mean, is that like a, does that totally cause the colony to have to work super hard for a long time, or what does it do?
That's true. Yes. So there is a trade-off between, you know, using and reusing the same comb and keeping it there, because you're right. There's a lot of effort into making wax. So this is a really cool behavior. Honeybees have four pairs, so eight total wax glands in their abdomen. And when they need to activate them, they release little droplets of molten wax that immediately with the air hardens into a scale, a very thin see-through scale that then they move to their head area, and with their mandibles and with some secretions, they mold into kind of like the Play-Doh that they use for making comb. So it is indeed an expensive process, because they use all the energy they're consuming just to build wax. But that's how colonies grow. So they're used to building wax for when, let's say, they run out of room, or they just started a new nest, and so they need to build comb for the new nest. So they do it all the time, and if you remove the wax, the colony will notice that it's run out of space to put away food or to rear babies, and they will build more comb. And so it's a trade-off between, you know, the energetic cost of building more comb, but the positive aspects of using comb that has not been treated with chemicals.
Well, how do hives get treated with chemicals? Are they just sprayed, you know, ad libitum, or like, you know, how does it happen?
So the beekeepers use several products that are out in the market for the treatment of parasites and pests. So as I said, the varroa mite, that's the one that we are most concerned about. And so the beekeepers are using pyrethroids, organophosphates, formamidines, some organic acids that are known to kill varroa mites. And it's a tricky game where you're trying to kill another arthropod, the mite, but you're trying to keep the honeybees alive. And so it's difficult to find a product that does both things at the same time. And so the beekeeper opens the hive, and depending on how big the colony is, you know, like the typical beekeeper box with 10 frames each, if you have two or three of these boxes, then the treatment will tell you to add a couple of strips or more strips, depending on the size of this product. So the bees then, they work through contact, most of them. And so the bees will walk near these treatment strips, and the mice that are on the bees get some of that product and then get killed. So, but in doing that, the bees will also come in contact with the wax, and the wax will then act like a sponge and collect the chemicals and they will stay in there indefinitely until you replace the comb later on.
I mean, do these treatments work to stop varroa mites, or, you know, are they just as destructive as they are helpful? Like, what happens when you treat a colony?
In terms of varroa mites, a colony that has anything above a 3% infestation level, that means maybe three mites per every 100 adult bees, is considered at risk of collapsing because of all the viruses that the mites can transmit. So they need to be treated. So anything above 3% infestation level need to get treated for varroa mites. Unfortunately, because as I said at the beginning, the varroa mite is really not a natural enemy of the Western honeybee that we have here, the bees didn't really have a lot of tools to combat them, and so beekeepers got an emergency authorization to use really, really harsh chemicals. One known as, well, the trade name was Apistan. The common name is fluvalinate. It's a pyrethroid, very harsh chemical. All of these are used in other agro ecosystems for killing other types of pests. And the mites became resistant in the 1990s to fluvalinate because we kind of used and abused it. So then they get another emergency authorization for another product, Cumafos, which is an organophosphate. And within 10 years, mites became resistant to Cumafos. And even today, even though people don't really use fluvalinate or Cumafos much anymore, we still continue to see those two products in the wax.
If you like this podcast, please click the link in the description to subscribe and review us on iTunes.
And that is because we continue to use the same wax over and over. And how does that happen? Well, there are some beekeepers that part of their business is to collect wax from bees and beekeepers around them or their own colonies. And then they clean up the wax and melt it into blocks. And then they use those blocks to create what we call sheets of foundation. So it's like a very thin sheet of wax that has that hexagonal cell pattern. And we provide those to colonies as a template so that they can create these beautiful hexagonal cells. They don't really need it, but we provide them with these sheets of foundation kind of as a head start. It saves them a little bit of time. Well, some of that wax that is used for the foundation that you buy from all the beekeeping supply companies, they are not 100% clean because there has been so much utilization of chemicals in our beekeeping industry in the last 40 years that it's almost impossible to find completely clean wax. And so it kind of perpetuates the cycle of pesticide presence in the colonies.
Mm. So in terms of helping the bees with a wax template, you said it helps them a little bit or a lot. Are there ways that you've thought of that work better?
Well, most beekeepers will use either that wax template, we call it foundation, just because it also gives the bees a template for a more organized pattern. So there's three types of bees in a colony. You have the queen, and the queen is reared in a completely unique cell that is looks like a peanut, almost like a peanut shell. It's huge and it's oriented vertically compared to the typical honeycomb that you see in the store, which is oriented horizontally. The cells are, anyway. And that honeycomb that you see at the store in a jar of honey, that one is for workers, which are the females, the vast majority of the individuals in a colony. But you have a third organism, which is the drone or male. The drones are larger in size, maybe by 50% larger than the workers, and so they need bigger space to develop. And so in the reproductive season, in the spring and summer, the bees that make this wax in the wax cells, they will create bigger cells for drones to accommodate their bigger size. Well, a lot of beekeepers don't really like drones because drones, they're only role is to reproduce with queens, but they don't really do any other tasks like collecting food or, you know, nectar or pollen. So if you leave a colony open without any kind of wax foundation template, they will build both worker and drone comb as needed. But if you only provide them with wax foundation that has only worker template for worker cells, then they will abstain from creating drone comb. And so that means that there's more room for honey storage instead of drone production.
Is it the shape of the comb that determines, you know, the shape of the template that determines what they'll make or other factors?
Absolutely. Well, other factors. But the shape is the same. It's hexagonal, but it's the size of the cell. So the diameter, the overall size is bigger for drones and also taller because the drones are much bigger. And so the colony has this very unique innate awareness of the needs of the colony based on growth and the time of year. So in the spring is when bees will reproduce. And when they need to reproduce, they will, if the colony is large enough, it will swarm. And that's why some people may have seen swarms or clusters of bees on tree branches. That means that maybe the day before or that same day, the colony that was large enough split into two units. The swarm colony is the one that has the mother queen, and it will move from that cluster of bees to a new tree cavity they found somewhere days prior or that same day, and they will establish a new nest. So it's only adult bees that go back in the parental nest where they came from. They will have started to rear new queens, and one of them is going to ultimately inherit that colony. And so she's going to come out as a virgin. She needs to mate with drones. And honeybee queens mate with, on average, 12 to 15 drones in a succession of only, that lasts only maybe 1 or 2 days. And they will store the sperm from all of her drone partners for like 3 years, 2 to 3 years. So this only happens in the reproductive season, which is in the spring or summer, which means that there needs to be drones for queens to mate with. And that's when drones are produced. They are only produced in the reproductive season because they're expensive to make. They eat a lot. They're fatter. They're always out there trying to look for a mate. And if they're not mating, they're back in the nest just feeding and refueling to go back out. So they're only produced in the reproductive season. And that's when the workers will create drone comb for drone production.
Well, so can you, curate a hive and take out, the majority of the drone comb, just leave enough that where enough drones are made to mate with the queen, but, minimize that and maximize, like replace it with the worker comb?
So that's a good point. Some people do that, especially if they're interested in just honey production. If they're, say, beekeepers that live, whose livelihoods depend on the amount of honey that they can pull from colonies. But if you are a hobby beekeeper with a few colonies and you're interested more in just learning about the biology of the honeybee, you will soon realize that it's very important to maintain a natural ratio of workers and drones in the colony, especially in the reproductive season. So one thing that I want to point out is that honeybee queens don't mate with their brothers. They don't mate with relatives. So it's not like queens that are made in a colony in the spring will mate with the same drones from the same colony that are being made at the same time. That would become a big problem with inbreeding. So the way that they evolved to avoid inbreeding is that queens, virgin queens, will fly about a mile away from where their source colony is. So they will leave the first day or two, they will do what are known as observation flights. So it's basically short distance flights that to learn, so they can learn the landmarks around them. And then when they're comfortable enough to fly out, they will fly about a kilometer or a mile away to mate. Whereas drones from that same colony are going to stay close by. So they're only going to fly maybe at most, 100 yards or so from their source colony. And that's for two things. So that they don't mate with that queen that flew a mile away. So that distance kind of precludes them from mating with relatives. And also because they have to go back and forth all day long, just trying to mate with as many virgin queens as they can mate with. What I mean is find mates that they can mate with in the vicinity where queens are produced. Because interestingly, drones only mate once and they die during copulation. So they if they're lucky enough to find a virgin queen, they copulate, and immediately upon copulation, they let go of the queen and their reproductive organ stays inside the queen and breaks off. Basically, they drop to their death because they become dismembered.
So they copulate and they leave not just the sperm, but the whole reproductive organ inside the queen?
Well,
really?
So the reproductive organ of honeybee drones is called, one term is the endophallus, endo inside phallus reproductive organ. And the endophallus is all tucked in inside the abdominal cavity. And that's also why their bodies are so big and their abdomens are so big, because they have to have all their reproductive organs tucked in. They only invert them once in their lifetime, only when they have the right stimuli, which is the smell and the feel of of a queen up in midair. So they meet somewhere up in midair, and he finally, the lucky one, will invert the end of phallus, insert it in the queen's vaginal cavity, and then as soon as that happens, they break the end of phallus, the tip of it, and they drop to their death. And so it's a very traumatic traumatic death. In the drones that don't make it, they don't find a suitable mate, will then get evicted from the colony by the workers in the fall, because they realize, you know, there's no more queens to mate with, and that's their sole purpose, is to mate with queens. So if they're not being of use for reproduction, they're too expensive to maintain. So you don't have drones out there over winter. It's only the workers, and then the drones are all kicked out and basically starve to death in the fall if they didn't die from trying to mate. So it's kind of an obscure way of life for drones, because they're only produced seasonally. They work really hard. They hope to mate, but most of them probably don't. And if they don't, then they get killed by the workers in the fall.
What a tough existence.
Yeah, so they... Let's say, you know, it's they go one way or another. But in, you know, in evolutionary biology terms, the drone acts more like a flying sperm cell, that is, their sole purpose is to basically pass on the genetic material from his predecessors to the next generations of offspring.
Right. So, okay.
Yeah.
Well, what happens to the endophallus once they're in the queen? Does her body strip away the endophallus just to get to the sperm, or how does it work?
That's a great, great point. So as I said, the queen mates with about 12 to 15 drones. And this happens as quickly as maybe within a half hour. Cause what they do is they fly, as I said earlier, like maybe a mile away, but they go to a place that has been called a drone congregation area, which is basically a place where drones somehow assess that this is a really cool spot to locate potential mates. It has to have big visibility. So think of maybe some open outdoor space, like a prairie or something that has, or a pasture land that has a lot of opportunity for visually encountering incoming traffic, let's say. So they create these drone congregation areas, which are clouds of drones from all the nearby colonies. Thousands of drones are around these clouds just looking for virgin queens that are also flying looking for mates. And so once a virgin queen is intercepted by a drone, he leaves the endophallus in there, and then he drops to his death. So then another one comes in and takes the endophallus, we call that a mating plug, takes the endophallus with her mandibles and legs, takes it out and inserts his and mates with that queen. Then the third one does the same thing. Another third drone will take out the mating plug from the previous mate, insert his, deposit the sperm, and it happens like that for 12 to 15 times. Can you believe that? Then the last one, the last mate, will leave the endophallus or the mating plug in the queen, and then she comes back to her colony, to her hive, and then the workers are the ones that remove the last mating plug. Yeah.
Okay. So they, I guess they service the queen, but so when the mating plug, well, the endophallus is in there, that's what releases the sperm into the queen, or again, do
that's
we know
right.
what happens?
So there's, we do know. So there, it releases the sperm, and it's thought that, leaving the endophallus inside helps with sperm transfer. So it helps to release even more sperm inside the vaginal cavity. But really what happens is it takes about 48 hours for the sperm to migrate up to the receptacle called the spermatheca that stores all the sperm. And only about 3% of the sperm that she collects from all of her mates, 10, 15 mates, only about 3% makes it up to the spermatheca. The rest, it kind of basically oozes out of the queen. And in any case, even though that's such a small percentage, the spermatheca will contain anywhere from 3 to 5 million sperm cells. that she will stay and keep using every day for the duration of her life. So
how was, when she produces eggs, how does she know which male to use to fertilize the eggs?
She doesn't. Is there a choice? So there's no choice, no. It's whatever comes, at the bottom of the spermatheca. It's well mixed. And so, it's kind of at random. Or if it's too packed, like at the beginning of the, right after mating, because there's so much sperm in the spermatheca, there might be some packed kind of batches that the queen may use in succession. And so you may have a few patches of workers that have the same dad. But
is it random if she lays 1,000 eggs? But if she lays 1,000 eggs or 1,000 to 2,000 eggs, are all of them from the same father? Or would you expect to get from 10 different fathers?
Oh, yeah. It's from all of the fathers. There's going to be, if you look at 1,000 workers, you're going to have a good representation of all 10 or 12 fathers in that batch.
Oh, okay. Because it mixes.
The sperm is mixed in the spermatheca. It's just that, let's say, because it's too tightly coiled, maybe you will find that there's 5 of the same father and then 5 of the same father, but there's nothing. She doesn't do any selection of what sperm she's going to use.
No, there's no difference seasonally or, as she's getting through as the spermatheca is emptying, there's no change in the mixture of, workers produced.
There can be a little bit of patchiness, but it's not something that is done on purpose. It might be because, as I said, it might have been coiled up together during sperm transfer because of the way the sperm is arranged. It has a really thin head or acrosome, but it has a really, really, really long tail. And because newly mated queens don't have a lot of space in the spermatheca, the sperm is fully coiled up. It looks like a tangled mess. And so in that respect, when she's using portions of the sperm to start fertilizing eggs, there can be, delivery of sperm from the same father just because they happen to be coiled up together, but not because she said, oh, this is going to be Johnny's daughter and William's daughter. Yeah, nothing like
that. Well, I just didn't know if there's any sensing of the quality of the males. And so in the season, as it goes on, there's any differences, but
there doesn't seem to be that.
Okay.
But that's a good question, but no, it's all been an evolutionary strategy to increase genetic diversity in the colony. And it's been shown through several studies that genetic diversity increases a colony's ability to withstand and tolerate disease, but also be more productive. So certain genetic lines are better at foraging for pollen, some are better for foraging for nectar, some are better for foraging for water or tree resins. And so having all of that diversity within one colony benefits the overall performance of the colony. So it's good to have all that genetic richness.
But if the queen doesn't mate with her brothers, how does she orchestrate a time where there'll be 10 to 15 different males around for her to mate with from another hive?
That's a great question. It's all about the colonies undergoing the same environmental cues. So just like everything coming to life in the spring, birds, trees, animals come out of either diapause or hibernation because of temperature changes and the length of duration of daylight. There's the same kind of cues that tell honeybee colonies that there's a lot of food out. They go out, collect a lot of food. The queen, it's warm enough for the queen to start laying eggs again. The colony starts packing up all the food that they can get. They start running out of space. It's too crowded inside. And so all of those cues, plus the daylight duration and the temperatures, tell the colony it's time to split, which is the swarming. And so during that time is when they start rearing new queens for the upcoming swarming season. And that's when they start making drones. So colonies that are strong, that have a good population, they kind of know ahead of time what's to come, and they start preparing by producing a lot of drones for the swarming season. And because all the colonies are undergoing the same environmental pressures and cues, all of them are being prepared in the same manner. And that's why you find that on a very beautiful, sunny day, and depends on where you are in the country. In Texas, it starts occurring in as early March, but in some parts of the country, it can be June, depending on the, you know, when it's 80, 85 degrees out, beautiful blue sky, low winds, plenty of forage out. You will see several colonies swarming at the same, because they just get, they like the same environmental cues that tell them it's the right time to swarm.
So when they swarm, that's when the males will go from, you know, they'll go find the queens and meet up and
around that time. So swarming is decoupled from mating. Swarming is the colony level fissioning, and that's just the process of the swarm leaving with the mother queen. And because the mother queen is already mated, she doesn't need to mate. She never mates again. Queens only mate once in their life, and that's it. But what I mean about the swarming season is that once that swarm leaves, back in the parental nest are all the virgin queens, some of whom will survive, and then they will need to mate. So all the colonies are in preparation for that individual level mating, which is the actual copulation of those virgin queens with drones. And all of that happens at around the same time.
Oh, and like this gigantic swarm?
Yeah.
Sounds like a very social event, it sounds like.
The swarming is a very social event. It looks very chaotic. If you have ever witnessed a colony swarming, if you've never seen that, you get scared because it's a cloud of bees that you think is completely in disarray and unorganized. But in reality, it's an event that takes only 20 minutes, 30 minutes, and it is quite organized, and it's all guided by pheromones, odor cues, organized by a few individuals in the colony, and quite precise. And they're incredibly gentle when they're swarming. So you can be surrounded by a cloud of bees, and they will not sting you. Preoccupied doing something else, you know, leaving the colony for forever, basically.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, very interesting. So what are some milestones in your research you're hoping to achieve over the next couple of years?
Great question. So we showed some of the impacts of these agrochemicals on honeybee queens and drones, and now I'm more interested in learning about how nutrition affects reproductive quality. So the type and amount of nutrition that these queens and drones get, not only as adults, but also when they're developing, how that affects queen quality and drone quality. We're doing some studies on worker foraging behavior and nutrition. So we're trying to look at whether bees are using pollen, which is their source of protein. If they're using certain pollens that have different ratios of protein to lipid to micronutrients, they're using different types of pollen to try to improve their health, especially when they are challenged with diseases like the formed wing virus or the fungal pathogen Nosema. So are bees, when given a choice, do they use diets that are higher or lower in protein or lipid amounts to help them improve their chances of withstanding these infections? So using nutrition as a way to kind of like self-medicate almost to help improve their immune responses to disease challenges.
You mean you're seeing if they change, well, I mean, they're pollinating different types of flowers throughout the season, right? So
yes.
I guess there's nothing they can do about, but
that's right.
Is it the mixture of pollen versus honey that they take from the plants that they're working with, or how are they modulating?
The way we're doing it is more in a controlled way in which the beekeeper can actually manipulate the diet of the bees. So we do a lot of, in beekeeping, there's a lot of supplementing the nutrition of bees by either giving them protein supplements or even for honey production, people want to take most of their honey to make money selling the honey. So they feed them sugar syrup and take all the honey out. So we do a lot of manipulation in that way. So if you give them an artificial diet that has a specific protein to lipid ratio, for example, can it help them when they have, let's say, high levels of Nosema disease, which is a fungal pathogen that disrupts their digestive system? And so that's kind of something that we're looking at right now. And there's some evidence that they seem to be selecting for the, when given a choice, they seem to be selecting for diets that have a specific protein to lipid ratio, which can tell us that they might choose them in a way that helps them improve their chances of lowering the levels of these viruses and disease. So we're in the beginning stages of that, but there's our lab and other labs across the country are looking at how to improve nutritional ecology in honeybees, even with, if it is with supplemental diets. So diets that you can create for beekeepers to provide to their bees. It's, of course, it's ideal to have a balanced diet that is natural and that has the perfect combination of amino acids and all the protein that they get. But the reality is the bee season for pollen is not very long. And the rest of the year, the bees have to either starve sometimes because there's not, they didn't collect enough pollen, or they have to rely on the beekeepers giving them supplements. And the supplements that we're giving them are probably not the best in terms of all of these micro and macronutrient ratios. So that's what we're looking
at. What about a bee that's that has varroa mites? Do they tend to pollinate differently or eat different things or take different things from the flowers they pollinate?
Well, that's a great question. There doesn't seem to be evidence that they forage preferentially for specific chemicals, but they do. There's some bees that have what we call social immunity. And so they, for instance, go and collect resins from trees and they turn that resin into what we call propolis. I don't know if you've ever heard of the word propolis because it's sometimes used in the cosmetics industry. But propolis is basically the product that bees, they call it the bee glue. And it's modified tree resin that they go to a tree. They collect the resin from that tree. They bring it back. They kind of regurgitate it back or mix it up with secretions. And then they create a glue. That glue is has very good antimicrobial properties. And so there are colonies that have a higher tendency to collect propolis. And they create what we call propolis envelopes. They basically kind of seal the whole colony with a kind of a layer of this propolis, and it helps them combat diseases. Not necessarily varroa, but bacterial and other types of pathogens in the colony. So they can forage for things, not necessarily pollen, but things that help them improve their health, in this case, propolis. But in varroa, what's most important about varroa is that we don't let the colony dwindle from having too high of a varroa load. So colonies that have a really high varroa load, they just don't do well at all. They don't forage almost. They're not as productive. They're more lethargic, all the bees. They live shorter lifespans. That means that they have fewer days of productivity per capita. And so all those things need to be considered when trying to do something against varroa. Continues to be the number one problem we have in apiculture. It's varroa mite.
Okay. Yeah. Well, very good. Juliana, what's the best way for people to find out more about your research? Where can they go?
We have a very active Facebook page. It's TAMU, as in Texas A&M University, TAMU Honeybee Lab. And you just look up Facebook on Facebook, TAMU Honeybee Lab. We have over 4,000 followers from all over the world, actually. It started as a, you know, just people in Texas, but I travel a lot for work, just speaking to beekeeping organizations. And we've now got people following us from, I think, almost every continent. And that's where we showcase all the research that comes out of our lab and all the presentations and conferences we're attending, but also showcasing the work of colleagues around the U.S. and the world that are doing really important work for pollinator health. Honeybee, you just look up TAMU Honeybee Lab, and it'll get you to the right place.
Very good. Well, Juliana, thank you for coming. It's been a very interesting call.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
If you like this podcast, please click the link in the description to subscribe and review us on iTunes.
You've been listening to the Finding Genius Podcast with Richard Jacobs. If you like what you hear, be sure to review and subscribe to the Finding Genius podcast on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. And want to be smarter than everybody else? Become a premium member at FindingGeniusPodcast.com. This podcast is for information only. No advice of any kind is being given. Any action you take or don't take as a result of listening is your sole responsibility. Consult professionals when advice is needed.